Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Sans Pants Radio. I am too cold.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to another episode of Movie Maintenance. I'm Gabe.
I'm Handsome Tom.
I'm Carney.
And today we're discussing the evolution of the blockbuster.
Well, the video rental franchise, obviously.
That would make a great episode.
That would. Do you know there's still one in my hometown?
That is amazing and I want to go there.
Now, it was there at least like 6 months ago, I want to say, and it used to be in a bigger building across the road that is now a cycling shop, but obviously with Blockbuster going into receivership, it has now moved across the road. It shares a block with a Subway.
Wait, so Blockbuster, yeah, it survived and they moved building?
To a small boutique.
When you go back to Geelong, do you go there sometimes? And is it weird to be in there?
Do you know, I
haven't been in one for years.
I don't go in there purely out of fear because I had so many overdue fines from the old Blockbuster that I'm just worried I'll walk in and an alarm will go off and I won't be able to leave. So I haven't. I'm tempted to. The video rentals places still exist.
But Blockbuster specifically is...
This is a block. My only thing is potentially it's owned by like Larry from Grovedale, and he's just kept the Blockbuster logo on the shop.
There's still a video store in my hometown, and every time I go home, I'm like, oh, I really just want to go in there and like browse the shelves for nostalgia's sake and all of that. And I just never do. Like, I would love to. I miss like going to the video store and everything, but
it's laziness. Nowadays it's like
just
got Netflix
and Netflix, that's the only one
I
use.
Could you imagine like video store and chill? Hey, do you want to go to my place in the video store? So you don't actually watch the movie, just walk around the video store holding hands for a bit?
So Blockbuster is in the type of film that we are discussing. So I guess like the best way to start off here before we sort of launch into this is what defines a blockbuster?
The first thing that comes to mind is budget, I think.
Yeah, because I mean, there's a lot of talk about the fact that Jaws was kind of the first blockbuster, but then I've always sort
not
of
not a lot of budget.
Things like not
was
really.
It though, and, like by you know back in the 70s was that
yeah but
decent?
There'd been a lot of much bigger films. I mean, even like going back as far as the 30s, like, you know, King Kong, Gone with the Wind, Wizard of Oz, so, Casablanca, Ben-Hur.
And what I think budget doesn't always play into it either, because you have big tentpole films that are actually made for surprisingly
Yep. I think it's a number of factors. It's the studio involvement. It's the stars that are attached to it. It's the marketing, I guess. It's with Jaws, it wasn't so much the production budget, but it was the fact that it was the first film that sort of had a major release where they dumped it in like a whole bunch of cinemas, which is common practice today.
Separated it.
Yeah.
And also because apparently prior to Jaws, releasing something during summer wasn't really a thing.
Yep.
But then, I don't know, even that, like when they say, oh, Jaws was such an event, you had to go see Jaws. I'm like, yeah, but you hear stories about like Psycho coming out in the 60s and people lining up around the block to see Psycho and stuff like that.
I think they used to roll films out a lot slower.
That was the thing with Psycho. They had to put signs up in Psycho at every cinema, don't spoil the ending, because it wasn't in every cinema. Whereas Jaws, they literally just went, put it in all of them.
Yeah. But I think, was that part of, because they went way over budget and they were kind of just like, let's just dump it in as many as we can, because they were just scared to roll it out slowly. They thought perhaps word of mouth might kill it. So they were like, let's just get it out there. And then people saw it and loved it. And then
I don't know specifically.
I watched it recently. That movie holds up so well. Yeah.
It's my favorite movie. And that's something we'll get into a bit later is sort of, I guess, the difference between a blockbuster like Jaws that kind of, I guess, defined the concept, and then blockbusters like what we have today with like Marvel films and whatever. But yeah, fuck, Jaws really does hold up beautifully.
So I think, is there what? Like, let's settle on some criteria here.
Yeah.
So is there what, four things that it has to do? So it's either, let's call it like a big budget or big production,
mm-hmm.
in terms of like it's seen as a big kind of thing, director, producer.
The other thing I think that's kind of important is being relatively high concept.
Yeah.
Is probably pretty key. I mean, if you think about most of the blockbusters, even the nowadays ones, it's like superhero films, and then going back to things like Jaws, like Star Wars, they're things that you can kind of summarize in one attention grabby sentence.
Yep. And I think it's the release date too.
Yes.
It's the American summer.
Yes, but that's only because of Jaws.
Blockbusters sort of later and earlier as well.
And so this is the thing, is that I don't necessarily think it's the release date. I think it's films that they get released like in a couple of cinemas, or they go to Sundance and then they get a release.
Yeah.
Often, particularly in Australia, we suffer from that thing where we'll get an American film much later.
But that's typically not the blockbusters.
No, that's what I mean. So the blockbusters kind of worldwide, everyone kind of gets it at once, and a lot of people go and see it.
By that logic, something like, you know, Lord of the Rings or even Star Wars, which was released in December, wouldn't be a blockbuster.
No, yeah, okay. But I think that's the evolution of the blockbuster, because I think I can't really think prior to Lord of the Rings what was coming out on like Boxing Day or whatever, but when Lord of the Rings started doing that and was massively successful, now that's a market.
Pixar used to monopolize the Boxing Day slot. Monsters Inc., Finding Nemo, their kind of go-to slot was always the Boxing Day.
No, but that was one after Fellowship of the Ring, for instance.
I don't know. Look, I'm not
shoot you down there, mate.
I'm not a mega expert on my Pixar release dates. So I guess like the kind of
it's
main...
It's my jam, Gabe.
Well, if
clearly not, because you just got it wrong. So,
no, moving on. They definitely. Anyway, I'm not saying they didn't, but they. Sorry.
So, I guess if we look at like coming back to, I think actually that's sort of a really good springboard to launch into this. Is what you said before about Jaws, like the fact that Jaws holds up, the fact that Jaws, aside from being a high concept, entertaining blockbuster, also is just a really, really good film. It's idiosyncratic in interesting ways. It's got great characters. It's got great dialogue. It's very memorable. It holds up kind of on all those levels because it's just made so well. And it not only doesn't diminish on repeat viewings, but rewards repeat viewings.
Yeah.
Whereas if you look at the blockbuster we get nowadays, like most of the Marvel films, I find they're events. You go and see them. Everyone's like, oh, have you seen the new Iron Man? Have you seen the new Thor? Have you seen the new Avengers? Whatever. But how many of those are you itching to go and rewatch again and again?
Are you suggesting that the evolution of the blockbuster is that over time they become more about the studio production side of it and less about...
Well, I kind of think that's unquestionably the way we've gone.
Or do they just get shitter?
I think part of it's the fact that, you know, obviously China's become such a big market. And so like a lot of these blockbusters are being made to kind of appeal for foreign audiences so that they can very easily get put in a different language and nothing kind of gets lost in translation. That's one part of it. I mean, nowadays it's the proliferation of sequels and things like that. It's relatively rare to get, unless you're Christopher Nolan, to get like a big budget blockbuster film that's a total original. It's not based on a well-known intellectual property.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Universe, obviously a big thing, but I guess going from Jaws and Star Wars in the 70s and the heydays of films like that, like Spielberg's heyday in the 80s, you know, Indiana Jones's, your ETs, all of those things are unquestionably blockbusters.
James Cameron in the 80s as well with sort of the aliens and your Terminators. Aliens,
things like that. And then coming through to the way it is today, I think one of the biggest differences is saturation. Like it feels to me like those big sequels were more of the exception than the rule back then. Like, I mean, how long was it between Terminator 1 and Terminator 2?
I think it's 8 years or something.
Something pretty extensive.
It's 80 whatever for Terminator, and then it's like 91 or 92 for Terminator 2, I think.
I think it's 84 for Terminator 1.
Whereas today that would be like a 2-year gap.
That would be unquestionable today.
Or or it'll either be a 2-year gap or a 20-year gap.
Yeah.
And they do the weird, oh, the sequel that nobody was kind of waiting for, but here it is anyway, guys.
Like a Tron or something like that.
Well, it's like a Tron. But
that's a different thing. That's like a nostalgia-based sequel.
Is it? And like, you still even have to this day stories where films are going to have a release on, say, like March 3rd, and then they find out like the new Transformers is coming out March 3rd as well, so they'll either button themselves a week earlier or a week later.
Yeah.
Or they're like, nah, we're going to go head-to-head with the new Spider-Man. Like, you kind of hear those stories, but you hear them less and less. Studios are just like, nah, bring it on. Coming up soon, we get a Spider-Man, we get Transformers, all within like a week of one another.
There was also that interesting thing that happened last year where Civil War and Batman vs. Superman were like scheduled for the same week or something.
And for a long time, they stuck to that.
And they did, and eventually DC blinked because someone had to blink.
They went earlier too, didn't they?
They went earlier, yeah.
They stuffed up.
Yeah. There's something that occurred to me today when I was kind of like doing, I guess like, you know, doing the groundwork for this episode. Because to me, I would argue the point at which things changed, because for a long time, sequels were kind of, like we said before, sort of more the exception, the rule, and we were kind of getting quite a few more original films and things like that. I would actually argue the point at which things really, really changed was 2007, because I remember very clearly in 2007, there was this whole big thing, all the film blogs and magazines, everything were talking about it, which was that we just had unprecedented amount of blockbusters coming out in a very, very, in very, very close succession with each other.
Great year for film too, if you go back and look at it.
Well, yeah, but I mean, the films we had at the time. Okay, so we had within weeks of each other, we had Spider-Man 3, Pirates of the Caribbean 3, Shrek 3, Bourne Ultimatum, Transformers, Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix,
Jesus,
and the Simpsons movie. Like, it was just kind of one after another that year. And I remember at the time there was like a big poster. There was a poster that was everywhere at Hoyts, and it was like the winter blockbuster, because, you know, America's summer is our winter.
Yep.
And it was like a poster of like the 10 must-see films. And it was like those plus, I guess, a couple of other ones that I've sort of forgotten about. But I do remember thinking, holy crap, there are so many sequels to so many big films coming out. And then after that, I mean, one year later, you know, we had Iron Man coming out in 2008, which kicked off the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Dark Knight.
And then I think there was this point where I remember a few websites talking about 2012 as being like the huge year for film, because we had the Avengers coming out, and we had the Dark Knight Rises coming out, and we had like all these kind of big significant films coming out. And everyone was like, oh shit, you know, it's unprecedented that we're going to have this big of a year for like huge blockbusters. Then they were like, oh, 2015 is the next one, because we have The Force Awakens, we have The Avengers Age of Ultron, and a bunch of other ones. And now it's kind of half the course. It's like every
it's just
year
common
we have
now,
those
yeah.
enormous tentpoles.
When you were younger, when you were younger, it was like you'd look at the release schedule for that year and be like, man, there's heaps of good like big movies coming.
It's
just every week now.
And that's it. Like, you know, and the biggest thing I've noticed, I think from a personal standpoint, is going back to 2012, like I remember, you know, and I don't really have a background of being a comics fan, but I remember when the first Avengers came out, I was so excited.
It was unprecedented though.
It had never been done before.
Making a film about a group of characters from other, like, again, these days it's, you know, part of the course we were saying, but this is the first time someone attempted, and that's stupidly ambitious.
And it was enormous. Yeah. And then, like,
let's create blockbusters, you know, to create a blockbuster.
This one argument I've kind of made about Star Wars for a while is that if you go back to when the prequels were coming out in the early 2000s, they were events. They were so big, because, I mean, not only, you know, was there that enormous gap before Phantom Menace came out, then it was like 3 years between films. And I remember when Attack of the Clones and Revenge of the Sith came out, they were huge. It was all anybody was talking about. I was so excited to go see the new Star Wars film. It was such an event. There was this sense at the time, which obviously proved wildly misguided, that Revenge of the Sith was going to be the last time we got to go to this universe. And now it's like, you fast forward to this day and it's like, you know, another Marvel film's coming out soon. There's another Star Wars film at the end of the year. And I just don't feel that excited, because
I'm still pumped for Star Wars.
Yeah, me too. Because they're a year apart, whereas Marvel, they do like 3 a year.
But isn't that the biggest difference though? Yeah. 1 year apart as opposed to 3 years apart. As opposed to 3 years apart, and then that's going to be the end of it. I mean, is anybody realistically thinking that episode 9 is going to be like
the end of that
year? No way.
But in my head though, already, as time's gone on, consumers and audiences are getting quicker and quicker and need stuff on a more constant basis. It's just the way the world works. We expect things quicker. Yeah. So isn't it weird that we kind of go, oh no, Star Wars is okay because we only get one a year, whereas Marvel films we get like two, DC you get two or three a year, and that's too much? So imagine when we get to a point where, you know, however many years from now, we're like, oh no, those guys are okay because they only give us three a year instead of eight.
Yeah. Well, I think this kind of, this bubble has to burst before that happens.
We would have thought, though, that it would have happened a long time ago.
I would have thought the bubble burst after BVS, but apparently not.
Well, no, because then Marvel did Civil War, and suddenly it was like, oh, that was actually all right.
And do you know what it is? Every time we think the bubble's going to burst, we get like Spider-Man Homecoming comes along and you go, oh, this could actually be pretty good.
Yep.
Wonder Woman comes along and you go, oh, the DC universe, film universe, got something kind of right this time.
Yeah.
So every time they give you a Doctor Strange or a BVS or an Ant-Man, they then give you another one and you go, oh, no, you know, I'm back on board.
They keep you hanging in there.
It's like, you know, you get the Winter Soldier after you get, you know, Ant-Man and Avengers
Thor
2.
And you get, like,
and
that.
All, yeah, and then all of a sudden, like, you know, we had a run of kind of mediocre ones. And we get Civil War again. That looks awesome. And then we've got Thor Ragnarok and Black Panther coming out and they both look pretty rad.
Yeah.
It's almost like there's more than one blockbuster released. Yeah. It's not like a period, so that they're happy to release like five blockbusters and they kind of grade them. So you have like your blockbuster, which is Civil War, and you have Doctor Strange, which is a blockbuster, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It's interesting. Marvel's interesting because they planned out till about what
2020 something.
Something like that. And like, that's just what they've announced. So on paper, like behind closed doors, they're even more planned out. At a certain point, this is going to burst and I'm just kind of fascinated to see what happens because at a certain point, people are going to be like, I don't want this anymore.
Okay, so here's a notion to throw out there. If you look at the precedent with superhero films, if you zoom back to like, okay, Tim Burton's Batman films, let's say, or
okay.
Christopher Reeve's Superman films, let's say. The Superman films were a bit different because they were sort of filmed back to back and it was...
And Donna had Batman a vision. Films,
you know, there were four Batman films ostensibly in the same series, including the two Joel Schumacher ones, and they're all essentially standalone films.
And they're very like, different tonally, with the exception of the first two by Burton.
Yeah. And apart from the fact that they share a Batman, they don't actually – you don't need to have seen Batman to see Batman Returns.
No.
You know?
Not at all.
And so
I quite like that too.
Yeah.
Because I don't like watching – I don't like the original Batman, but I really enjoy Batman Returns.
Yeah. And that's kind of the difference now, isn't it? Where like, you know, you – to see Civil War, you sort of have to have seen – like I remember when my dad saw Civil War, and I thought Civil War was great. And I told Dad to go and see it, and Dad doesn't really like the Avengers or the Marvel films or any of that. And he was like, my dad actually quite enjoyed Batman vs. Superman. But he came back from Civil War and he was like, oh, son, this was the worst film I've ever, it was so bad. It was just, made no sense, didn't understand it at all. And I'm like, well, and I was arguing it with him. And then he was like, and why was Spider-Man there? And why was Ant-Man there? What was this? And why was Tony Stark? Why did Captain America try to smash Tony Stark's heart? Then I was like, oh, well, the last one you saw. And I was like, oh, because in Iron Man 3, he got that taken out. And now he's got like, and I was like, holy shit, this film expects you to have seen so much. And then he was like, and who was this character? And I was like, oh, well, in Avengers Age of Ultron. And then in this, but it's like to a certain generation of cinema goers, like these are all different franchises.
It's
like
a TV series.
That you've, and that's it. That's what I was going to say. Is there an argument to be made that binge watching shows like Breaking Bad and whatnot and the way in which the box set kind of gained prominence in the early 2000s.
The way we consume content.
Yeah. Does that have a lot to answer for here?
Shit, yeah.
Yep.
And it's exactly the point I made before that not only do the audiences demand things quicker, we demand things that are connected.
Yes. And does that play into this whole thing where, you know, we've seen Lord and Miller get kicked off Han Solo. We've seen Edgar Wright get kicked off Ant-Man. We're seeing this basically, if you rock the boat or you don't fit into the company vision, is it like a director coming on to Breaking Bad and saying, yeah, I get that this is your house style, but we want to try something radically different. So are we sort of seeing more and more of these franchises are kind of going into this sort of more based on TV direction? And is that why, which is leading to my next point, is that why we've stopped expecting blockbusters to be great films?
I'd have sort of supported that, but the fact that Taika Waititi's doing Thor 3 kind of throws a spanner in the works a little bit.
But we haven't seen it yet.
That's true. I mean,
we haven't heard. So the whole thing with Edgar Wright was there were rumblings early that he was going to be kicked off Ant-Man.
Yeah.
Whereas Taika Waititi, it sounds like he's like been able to do. Now, again, it'll be, again, we haven't seen it, but speaking purely from the trailers, the way he's supporting it on Twitter, when the first trailer came out, he just put that tweet up being like, here's my new indie film for coming out later this year.
But is there an argument to be made that Taika Waititi's style fit more within what?
It fits Thor. It does. Yeah. It's a little bit off-center and it's a bit wacky and it fits him.
It fits Thor a bit. It probably fits Guardians more.
Yeah.
And then here's the question, though. Does it fit Thor because he's good for Guardians and that the Guardians' gateway into the franchise is through Thor?
Yep.
So, that again, works. He's actually a perfect choice.
Yep.
So the thing about Taika Waititi is that while he's doing his own thing, he still works for what they're doing, whereas they wanted Ant-Man to set up Hydra, to set him up for Civil War, whereas Edgar Wright just wanted to make a cool Ant-Man film.
And I mean, look, there's also something to be said for the fact that someone like Joss Whedon, who essentially created the Marvel house style, I mean, not created it because really that was Jon Favreau, but perfected the Marvel house style.
Even
he sort of, you know, got so fed up with Age
of Ultron.
He got
burnt out by it.
There were so many things that they were like, you need to do this and this and this and this. And he was like, I'm just trying to tell a story.
Was it after Ultron or after the first Avengers he decided to do Much Ado About Nothing?
After the first one, I think.
That's right, because he was like, oh, it killed me, so I needed to just do a little indie film of my own in my backyard for a weekend.
He got completely burnt out by Ultron.
And you can kind of see it.
Yeah.
That film's just...
has the whiff of studio interference.
Do you know what? Do you know what else though? Just this is something while you're talking, Gabe, about, you know, the expectation that you need to have seen everything in the franchise. So I watched Age of Ultron, and then I went back and started watching Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Now, there are things in Age of Ultron that I'm like, what is that? Who's that guy? Why are they in Russia? This makes no sense. Or not Russia, whatever made-up country they're in.
Yeah.
And then you watch Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., and in, like, season two, you get a beat where that Baron guy with the eye patch is, like, a main villain in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., and his whole kind of what he's up to makes sense there, and then all of a sudden Age of Ultron makes more sense. And you're like, the weak plot points are fixed in other content, which is a really cool idea. However, you still need to be able to appeal to just Bill coming in to watch it, which weirdly, Batman versus Superman does allow someone to come in having not watched Man of Steel.
Yeah,
it really does. Because it rehashes
everything you need to know in that first
everything
part,
you need to know.
But also, who cares? Because it's still a shit film.
It's still a shit film, but isn't
make,
it?
Just focus on guys. Making.
Good films.
One
first.
Good film.
Yep.
But I mean, then there's this whole other argument. I mean, like this, I think the fact of it is that like this whole new model of like cinematic universes and you having to have done all your homework to understand what's going on and all of
so
that.
So is it our fault, Gabe? Is that what you're saying?
Well, maybe, but like, I think the fact of it is, you know, it's, I mean, we're living in essentially the age of the geek where all of your sort of childhood intellectual properties are being resurrected in this like huge big budget way. But I guess there's an argument to be made that like, something like the Marvel Cinematic Universe allows for something like Civil War that can take all these disparate plot threads and bring them all together and do something big and huge that pays off a lot of stuff that's been set up through all these other things. But on the other hand, it's like, well, yeah, even Civil War has to be a piece of a bigger puzzle. So I guess the question here is, within this kind of infrastructure of universes and mega franchises and all of that, is there still room to, and this could be a really pretentious question, but is there still room to create actual art in there? Because something I've been thinking about with Star Wars is films like Jaws and the original Star Wars, they hit big and they captured imaginations because they were fresh and they were new and they hadn't really been seen before.
Yeah.
Then it's like, okay, then you see, you know, like the Lord of Miller getting kicked off Star Wars for trying something new. And my original instinct is like, oh, well, you know, like, you know, freshen up the franchise, try something new. But then it's like, well, again, is the argument to be made that you're trying to give people what they enjoyed the first time around, so you kind of have to fit the house style, but then is the path to actually creating the next Star Wars that's going to really grab someone's attention and seize someone's imagination to allow somebody to do something fresh? And can you do that within the framework? I don't know. There's so many questions that, like, because this is so unprecedented.
Do you know what makes me think that there are still people trying to do it, whether successfully or not? But there are still, you've still every now and again get clearly an attempt at a good old-fashioned blockbuster that's not part of a franchise. The film that's coming out, Valerian or The Land of a Thousand Planets,
that
looks balls to the wall absurd. It is a high-budget, high-concept, like sci-fi film that just looks insane, not part of an established universe.
Mm.
Could be an absolute disaster, but could still be pretty good. And yes, it's an adaptation of an work, but it's still... Lord of the Rings, that's still a creation of a new work, but that is a director who is clearly a vision. They are well-made films. Like,
yep.
It's when you think of franchises, name me a film franchise that's won an Academy Award recently. And not just for, like, makeup and special effects, but has actually won an Academy Award.
We can't talk about Suicide Squad.
So you can't. So what I mean is, though, like...
Define recently, because, I mean, I suppose you have Heath Ledger winning.
Heath Ledger's probably the last one.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't even... Like, you mentioned Lord of the Rings, and I just think it's too far back now because the landscape's changed so much.
I mean, Fury Road got nominated for Best Picture.
We could talk about...
But that's a weird one because it's...
That's a very weird one.
It's a very... Because you could watch Fury Road having never seen a Mad Max film.
Well, I would argue Fury Road makes less sense in the context of the other Mad Max films.
Yeah, if you've seen a Mad Max film. Yeah, so you could literally watch that on its own.
Gabe, if we go back to sort of talking about like the art, and the one that I guess you can always put up is like, well, Chris Nolan made The Dark Knight, but even that is about 10 years ago. Like a filmmaker couldn't do that anymore though because of the cinematic universes. Like someone can't come in and make like a brilliant standalone sort of Batman story because they're just not allowed to anymore because it has to connect with Superman and Wonder Woman and all the other ones.
Yeah. Christopher Nolan though is the exception to that. He's still doing, Inception, Interstellar, and then Dunkirk.
Yeah.
They're all standalone, huge budget. like tentpole picks, but he's been able to do that because he's built his reputation.
Yeah, exactly. He's got the clout to do that.
Yeah, and
you know, some people online will be like, oh, when's he going to make smaller films like Memento again? That's like, well, at the moment, he's got to milk this as far as he can because there will come a time soon where Chris Nolan can't make these $150 million films.
And here's the thing I will say. Who, you know, and the amount of capital they earn for The Matrix. And then you have Speed Racer, bomb. You have Cloud Atlas, bomb. You have Jupiter Ascending. What the fuck was that about?
But then in V for Vendetta as well.
They didn't direct that,
though. No, they wrote that,
didn't
they?
Even write it. They produced it.
Really?
Yeah.
No, they did the screenplay.
Are you 100% sure?
I'm about 80% sure.
I'm going to Google it while you guys have hashed it out.
I've got the laptop open right here. So
here we go.
Quickly
type it in. Is Sean O'Kant? Let's have a look. I reckon he is, and he's wrong. I reckon Shawnee boy's wrong.
It was. You're right. You're actually right.
Yeah.
There you go.
Did I say 80%? Can we retract that? I was 100%
Can
sure.
Can I also retract my song in which I called you a cunt and said you were wrong?
Nah, because I think, yeah, that's fair. Yeah, but they wrote and produced that. They didn't direct it. The Aussie guy did, James McTeague.
Yes,
yeah,
yes.
But isn't it interesting? You say the point of Nolan is that he's not going to be able to do those films anymore.
Well,
I 100% disagree. He's probably not going to be able to go back and make a Memento.
Yes, he can.
He could. But I think his next few releases, he's going to do big stories. No,
that's what I mean.
Because he's got the scope to do it.
Yeah, but Tom, what I mean.
And he'll keep doing it.
At a certain point.
No, never.
No, there will. Forever. Because all it's going to take is one bombed film and then he's going to have to go smaller.
But how many bombed films did it take before people stopped giving the Wachowskis money?
At a certain point, Chris Nolan is not going to have the opportunity to tell stories on a $150 million budget.
Yeah, but it's going to be a while. Because think about it, unless Dunkirk is abysmal.
Yeah.
But people will still, it'll make money.
If people still keep going to see his films,
it'll make money. It'll get nominated for awards because, let's be honest, while like people often criticize him for Heart and all that kind of stuff, he makes films that are visually stunning.
Yep.
I'm a big fan. Like he's – so he's – in terms of just like directing style, his films are stunning. He does practical effects. They look insanely beautiful. And as a director, that's a tick. Like, yes, all right, maybe his characters, you don't feel as much for them as you might. Interstellar, he kind of course corrected really hard. He just kind of needs to hit the middle for Dunkirk, I think.
Nolan copped it a lot for that in the Heart department, but I find Heart in most of his films.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Prestige has that.
It's not in your face Heart.
The Prestige has some of the best understated Heart, which it has that brilliant line
I completely
of,
agree
do you love
you.
Me? Not today.
Yep. Mate, I'm on board. I love the Prestige.
But see, I think it's fascinating to look at sort of directors who earn this capital to kind of do what they want because – I mean, it's testament to the cultural impact of The Matrix that the Wachowskis could have not only three in a row critical flops, but financial flops as well. And they still got three big budget blockbusters in a row that didn't.
Yeah. They've also got Sense8 on Netflix, which has now been canned. Although they're
coming back for the two hour
finale. But people loved it.
It's also just, it's so weird with blockbusters because you go through these different trends, I guess, where there's different genres of blockbusters. In the 90s, it was Roland Emmerich making things like Independence Day and that sort of thing. And now we've been stuck in comic book films for how long? Like
2010, I want to say.
Well, I mean, no, really, I reckon comic book films have been pretty decent moneymakers since probably the first Spider-Man. Probably
I reckon
the
first X-Men. First X-Men, jeez.
I mean, Blade, 2000, Blade isn't started it? X-Men.
It's been about
15 years. Is X-Men 99
years,
or 2000?
2000, I think.
Jeez.
I reckon you could definitely say that for 10 years we've been.
But they came along sporadically. Not, like they
sporadically, but not that sporadically. I mean, if you look at the early 2000s, I mean, we had the Sam Raimi Spider-Man trilogy. We had the original X-Men trilogy. We
had the Hulk.
Catwoman, Daredevil, Elektra, Hulk.
Yeah.
Like there were ones in there that weren't successful.
But they were still being made.
And then it dipped for a slight lull and then it came back with the
MCU. Then you got Begins.
Yeah.
But even before the MCU, you still had the Batman trilogy.
That's what I mean. So what you have is once it started to dip and people were like, oh, these are crap, you then got Begins, which people went, oh, you can make a cool superhero film. Then you got Dark Knight and people went, you can make a cool superhero film and Iron Man in the same year.
Well, here's the counter argument, I guess, about like, you know, not being able to make art within this kind of universe framework is you just kind of look towards Fox. And I guess, you know, art is subjective and all of that, but it's like
still
something
superhero
different
films.
And fresh and personal and actually beholden to someone's vision is, you know, your Deadpools and your Logans. And even on the TV scale, your Legions.
Still, Legion is... See, I think TV...
Things that are fresh and different.
True, but I still say that's still part of the superhero genre because I want to raise a point. You talked about blockbuster films being of different things. There was a period in the 90s and also in the 2000s when a blockbuster film was a big budget purely because of the cast comedy. I'm talking Hangover, Hangover 2, Hangover 3. You've got anything with Adam Sandler in it in the 90s when he was quite good.
Yeah.
we still get the big tentpole summer, American summer comedy release. Anchorman, those kind of Talladega Nights.
Do you count that as a blockbuster? Because I don't.
See, I count Hangover 2 and 3 as blockbusters.
But if you're talking Adam Sandler, are you saying things like Happy Gilmore were blockbusters? Because no, to me, they're not. To me, a blockbuster would have been Independence Day. It would have been Godzilla.
All right, fair. But are you willing to...
Speed, I think, is a blockbuster.
You're going to give me Hangover?
I would say...
Hangover, it's a different kind of thing. I don't actually think it's a blockbuster.
Hangover 2 and 3. I'm not saying the first one, because the first one was a sleeper hit.
And remember that, yeah, nobody knew it was. Beforehand.
And then the second and third one came out, they just upped the stakes, and people... went to them. Like, yeah. They made heaps and
also,
heaps
I mean,
of
then
money.
How do you count films like the Jump Street films, like Baywatch? I mean, that's another thing that maybe defines
comedy blockbusters.
Stars, because, you know, you put Jonah Hill and Channing Tatum in Jump Streets. They're unquestionably blockbusters.
Definitely star power. Like, you look at Spielberg's big blockbusters. I'll take Jaws out for a second, but you look at, like, Jurassic Park. You look at... actually, I'm not going to do Spielberg. I'm just going to do big blockbusters.
Yeah.
Jurassic Park, you do Independence Day.
Yeah.
You do something like Terminator.
Yeah.
You've got Arnold Schwarzenegger, who was like taking off at the time. You've got
anything with like Schwarzenegger, anything with Sylvester Stallone, stuff like that.
Back in those days. Well, Rocky's a blockbuster.
Yeah.
Maybe not the first one, but maybe definitely the sequels to Rocky. That's what I'm saying is that sometimes you can have a film that is not necessarily a blockbuster, but its sequels are. So Hangover, not necessarily a blockbuster. Hangover 2 and 3, blockbusters.
Definitely.
They're put middle of summer. They're probably competing with like an Avengers or a Thor or a Captain America. These days, yes, it's a lot of those kind of films, but I reckon you can have blockbuster comedies, and that's purely star power rather than production votes. Bridesmaids made a shitload of money and was hugely popular.
No, but see, for me, that's not a blockbuster until like when you look at it and go, oh yeah, it made hundreds of millions of dollars. Then it becomes, because prior to that, I wouldn't have called it a blockbuster.
I go back.
Yeah.
Hangover 2 and 3.
Yeah, okay, that works because they're sequels, but Bridesmaids fits in the Hangover discussion, the first Hangover.
All right, well, here's one, just delayed blockbusterification. Right?
Yeah, call
here's
it like
one.
A subgenre
here's one.
Of blockbusters.
Here's one.
Yeah.
Fast and the Furious is delayed blockbusterification. The first movie is a big action film, yeah, but it's like good. Second film's like dumb and
the
fun.
The first movie's a B-movie.
Yeah.
Like it was a B movie.
Third film came out, okay. Then they just didn't do anything for ages, and now all of a sudden they are one of the most like successful franchises in film. Mm-hmm. So is that a case again of maybe the first couple of films not necessarily being blockbusters per se?
Yeah.
And then by the time they start again getting stars in, they get The Rock in.
Yep. They're now, you know, obviously now they're blockbusters, but yeah, early on, no. The first three or four weren't.
Is The Wolf of Wall Street a blockbuster?
No, it's not. I know it's got a huge budget, but to me, like...
Huge budget, Leonardo DiCaprio and Martin Scorsese.
That ticks
three of the boxes.
Yeah, I know,
and
but
it's
I go more towards an action film.
Well, that's just genre, though. Action film is just a genre. Because Hangover 2 and Shrek 3 are blockbuster films.
Yeah.
I still wouldn't put Wolf of Wall Street in the blockbuster conversation.
I don't know if I would.
It's an Oscar, either, it's an Oscar-bait like, it's drama. Not, but the fact that it cost $100 million is because Scorsese makes... these elaborate films with huge stars.
All right. So then
also, it's not high concept.
Is the original
the blockbuster
is the original,
I think needs like even The Hangover is high concept.
No, it's essentially a biopic.
True, yeah,
it's not really
true. So does that mean though, the original blockbuster is the movie musical, right? They made shitloads of money. Studios would build their entire film release schedule around their big movie musical they were doing. They used to haggle and fight over stars, as we know. So you had like guys like MGM who did Singing in the Rain. They were huge. The budgets. So they're the movie musicals, but these days we probably would be like, Singing in the Rain, blockbuster? Nah. But in its day, Singing in the Rain would have absolutely been a blockbuster.
I guess, but I still think that Jaws is like the first blockbuster.
Well, it is because it had the first release schedule, but I think I'm going to say the original movie musical was the first blockbuster because it was big budget, high concept.
And then we had the Western after that.
And then
I mean, the argument is that after the Western came, you know, your new Hollywood, you know, your film school brats, your Coppolas, your Spielbergs, your whatever.
Which is Jaws.
But yeah, I think blockbusters, yeah, they can be defined by the genre. I think 80s and 90s, they're action. Now it's comic books. The 90s, it was a lot of stuff. It was like Jim Cameron doing True Lies, again, Independence Day, Speed, stuff
well,
like
then maybe
that.
But
then
the argument to be made.
Well, then you've just disproved your argument because you've said that a blockbuster has to be an action film, but you've just said the genre's changing.
Well, it does, but I don't.
Because you can also have horror blockbusters.
No, but you don't. What do you have?
What do you have? Anything after Saw 1?
They're not blockbusters, Tom.
They're tentpole releases.
I still don't.
People would mark their calendar to get a Saw film.
Blockbuster is like a Jim Cameron film.
Yeah, sure, but you can still. I reckon there are horror blockbusters.
There aren't. Yeah. Most horror films are low budget.
Halloween. Yeah, but they're
low budget.
Yeah, okay.
But high concept.
But high concept.
Like The Hangover was low budget.
Huge release.
Even the sequels would have been low budget. Like huge release. People go to them.
Lasting. Like, people. Iconic. There you go. Blockbusters. Yeah, on top of that,
Nightmare on Elm Street in the 80s.
Yeah, but iconic is something. Iconic is something that comes after a release.
Yeah, so does.
So it's not like we're developing a blockbuster film because they don't know it yet. It's such a small, low budget thing. And then they, years from now, you go, that's an iconic
film. But Tom's saying Jaws, they didn't know they were making a blockbuster film when they made Jaws. They didn't know that till after.
The term blockbuster film didn't exist before Jaws.
Well, no, but I'm just saying that's just because we've. Well, that's a label, like, mate. Let's You're getting into semantics here, and I disagree.
Let's make the argument
stupid
here for a second.
Yeti slippers.
Like, because here's something I think Tom's gotten onto talking about the movie musical and then the Western and then New Hollywood. Maybe Jaws wasn't necessarily the first blockbuster, but it did perfect what a blockbuster is, which is
a
high concept tentpole rolled out all around the world at the same time, capitalizing on a lucrative release. But before that, I mean, yeah, like, how do you define huge Hollywood movie musicals if not as a blockbuster? How do you define the big, huge
the
westerns?
Money that went into them is insane.
So it's, you know, maybe like they were blockbusters in development. I mean, we do have to remember that film isn't an ancient medium. It's been around for really just over 100 years now.
Charlie Chaplin would have been a blockbuster star in his day.
Yes, before we really knew what they were.
Sean's buying that. my argument is, Sean, that Jaws gives us, as you said, the clearest idea as a reference point, but that's only the reference point we've given it. There have been films that would be blockbusters of their day.
Yeah.
And I think making Jaws a blockbuster kind of can narrow the definition of blockbuster.
And Jaws was unquestionably a watershed moment for cinema because it sort of was like, all right, cool, now we make big money on these like high concept releases, release all at the same time, roll it out, all of that. And now it's developed to what we have today, which is, you know, franchises and cinematic universe and things like that.
To rebut your point, I just have to keep doing this.
I don't remember what my point was.
No, just about how Oscar bait then big budget Oscar bait.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yep.
Titanic.
Wasn't Oscar bait, mate.
You sure?
Guarantee you.
They make that film and go, we're telling it a true story. It's large scale, but it wasn't. Was it released in like summer? Or was it? I feel like it was released like towards awards season.
The release
season
probably changed because of how over budget and how, you know.
Titanic also came out at a time before Oscar bait was such an ubiquitous thing. Because now it's all like, you know, so again, serious dramas about issues. Titanic came out at probably the end point of the time when the Oscars were still willing to actually. I mean, but then again, then you get into the whole thing. It's like, you know, do you count Silence of the Lambs a blockbuster? I mean, Star Wars was nominated for the Oscars in the 70s.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
I'd say Titanic is
Titanic's
a blockbuster.
Not Oscar bait.
Titanic's definitely a blockbuster.
But in the same way that Wolf of Wall Street.
No,
is
it's
a
not because, and again, it's an action film. It's an epic scale.
It's a
film.
Love story, Sean.
It's a love story and a disaster film. It's an epic scale.
So is Wolf of Wall Street.
It's maybe epic in its ambitions by the filmmaker, but it's a biopic about a guy.
I do definitely argue. I don't agree that Wolf of Wall Street is a blockbuster.
I don't think I do either. I just want to argue.
Look, fair enough. But okay. So I guess coming to where we are now, I guess the evolution of blockbuster, we've gone from, you know, your Jaws's and your Star Wars and your kind of like high concept studio risks to this point where we're essentially living in the age of the franchise universe. And then you have things like Fox where it's like, we don't really give a shit about continuity. We just let you kind of throw out whatever and then you
but
get
still
a
still within a superhero genre.
Still within the superhero genre, but does prove that there is scope to make art and different things within that. So I guess coming to this point where we are now, we're perpetually wondering at what moments the superhero franchise bubble is going to burst. Where do we go from here? Because in the last few months alone, we've had films such as The Mummy, which was meant to be the start of another cinematic universe, which has flopped or, you know, not done as well as I expected.
The original Mummy films are blockbusters.
Yeah, yeah. The Pirates of the Caribbean 5 didn't do well at the box office. Or, I mean, it did well, but it basically underperformed. Pirates underperformed, The Mummy underperformed, Transformers, the new one, underperformed, Despicable Me 3 apparently underperformed. We're seeing more and more of these films underperforming. Is that to say that people are getting fed up of getting served the same stuff again and again and again, just repackaged?
It's hard to judge because that's Pirates 5, that's Transformers 5. What's Despicable Me up to? What is that?
Three. So the thing about, so that's what I mean. Like, so Pirates, no one was wanting a Pirates 5. No one was screaming out for a Transformers 5. The exception is, and you look at Wonder Woman, it's broken BVS's and Man of Steel's box office in less time. Yep. So people aren't stopping. Like, look at Guardians of the Galaxy 2.
Wonder Woman is good. Pirates 5 is not. Do you know what I mean? Maybe that plays into
but
it
maybe,
as well.
Well, that's part
maybe,
of it.
Maybe the critical reception is now becoming relevant to these superhero films, whereas probably previously 5 years
used
ago
to be
it didn't.
Critic proof. And okay, oh, that's an idea. That's something I hadn't thought about. Okay, because it used
you
to
have
be,
this mad fucking gleam in your eye right now, and I'm terrified.
It, well, I mean, it always used to be that these huge tentpole films, and they were always referred to in reviews and in articles and everything as being critic proof. Is that it? Because the franchise and the tentpole has become the trend, does that mean we're getting to a point where they're no longer critic proof because there's just so many that we have to go for the ones that we're told are good?
I would say
so
yes.
People go and see Wonder Woman and not Pirates 5 because they hear Pirates 5 is shit. Wonder Woman's good. I've only got enough money to go and see one film this weekend. What am I going to go to?
Again, though, that's hard to judge because they're performing, some of them are underperforming domestically in America, but they're still doing fine overseas. Like The Mummy has been garbage in America, but overseas it's doing fine. So that franchise is going to, the Dark Universe is going to kick on.
Which will be really good, Sean. I can't
wait. I'm really excited about that and can't wait for it. But I don't know. So what is it about the American audience that's making them kind of be like fatigued with the bullshit, I guess? I don't really know.
It could purely come down to release schedule. So it could be that as a, like, yes, we get blockbusters the same as everybody else. But so they might get Lego Batman and two other, and Baby Driver and like another film the same week that they get The Mummy, whereas we get The Mummy. Or we get Mummy and Pirates 5. And that's the only two we get, whereas they might get four or five options.
And then there's the China factor, because wasn't it – okay, correct me if I'm wrong, because I could totally be talking out of my ass with this, but is it true that not that long ago China was very selective about which Hollywood blockbusters it let through?
I don't have
and
the –
And it's only just kind of opened the doors more. So they've got things like Iron Man 3 having like a Chinese subplot edited in for the Chinese version.
There are several co-productions and stuff like that, but I don't know the specific – figures, but it might be something like they'll take 30 US films a year. And that's
yeah,
it.
Okay.
So you get so your Iron Man 3s that are like, hey, pick us because we'll have this Chinese element to it.
Or
so,
pick us because we've got Brad Pitt, Angelina Jolie, Matt Damon, that kind of thing.
Yeah,
star
for
power.
Instance, and I mean, Richard Gere doesn't have that much star power anymore, but I just read an article or an interview with him yesterday where he was saying he has been cast in films and then it's had Chinese backing and they hate him over there because he's very vocal about China and Tibet and all that sort of thing. And they get him kicked off films and that sort of thing. So China have like this huge power now. So
that's because people want it. Because the Chinese market is.
That is fascinating. Like he's been heavily in pre-production on films and the director will call him up and said, like, China have called me and said that I'll never be allowed to go home to my country again if I put you in my film.
It's logical. Like you want to go and see a huge blockbuster. Like imagine, I know it's different because like it's a different economy, different film marketplace.
Can we do that with Johnny Depp just in the Western civilization? sorry, we won't fund your film. Why? Because it's got a dickhead in it?
Can you imagine a world in which we're sitting here in Australia and the Australian government's like, oh yeah, nah, so you get 30 US films a year and everything else has to be Aussie content. So welcome the deluge of suburban misery porn.
Can I just say though, it would start off with a deluge of suburban misery porn and a lot of ochre crap. Eventually, you would get some really good shit.
You'd have to eventually because that's all people can go to. But you imagine how big those US films are going to hit. I mean, eventually you get fed up with suburban misery porn. All you want to do is go and watch fucking Wonder Woman.
Yep.
And so, you know, you get those films.
Suicide Squad.
So, yeah, I would kick Richard Gere off my film if China was, you know, if I was vying for a Chinese audience.
But imagine that. Imagine like
he's got the Tibetan market corner, though.
Imagine once a month you get a big American film here. Of course everyone's going
to
go watch
it. Well, that's probably what it was. Like, actually, do you know what? That's exactly what it used to be. Mm. So is one of the issues that the blockbusters evolved weird because of saturation? And will we eventually, when the superhero bubble does burst, because things are cyclical, what's going to be the next thing? Is it, will it be a war film, sci-fi? What's going to...
Will Westerns come back in? What is it? Who knows?
It looks like, I mean, I know that horror has never been, you know, the dominant genre.
Could be the movie musical just quietly.
Maybe, but I mean, like... It does feel like we're sort of looking at like a bit
original
of a,
movie musicals. Don't give me that.
It does feel like we're looking at a bit of a horror renaissance lately because, I mean, horror's heyday was the 80s. You know, it was your slasher films. It was your Freddy's, your Jason's, your all of that.
But now it's blockbusters, Gabe. Sean.
Anyway.
Kearney.
Now it's like, you know, your Conjurings, your Insidiouses, your things like The Babadook that do really well, things like Get Out.
Scary.
And it kind of feels like horror's sort of make. I think horror is too unappealing to a certain market, Sean Carney and Tom Reed, to actually, you know, be that dominant four quadrant thing that everybody goes to see.
Yeah, I don't want to say that it will never be the genre, but I don't think horror can be.
Because it's specific. And look, the proof is in, like, how many people went and saw Rings?
I went and saw Rings.
No, what I mean is, like, in general, like, it wasn't.
How many people went to see it thinking this could be good?
Well, yeah.
I think the other thing with horror, too, is that they're generally low budget.
But they're very creative, and that plays into it. And I don't think horror, I don't think you ever want to get to a point where you've got this slew of horror films that cost $150 million.
So maybe here's an argument to be made, because if you look at the 80s, I would sort of argue that the action film didn't have a stranglehold on the marketplace the same way the superhero film does now. Because in the 80s, it was, you know, your romances and your action films and your horror films. And there were a lot of like mid-budget films, some of which broke through and hit blockbuster status. Yeah. And then would go on to make lots of sequels, like Nightmare on Elm Street or whatever.
And you've Friday the 13th.
Maybe that was a healthier film marketplace because more original stuff got made. Whereas now it's like, it's a superhero film and let's face it.
Or an indie. Whereas filmmakers complain that there aren't that many mid-budget films
and
anymore.
And the ones that are exceptions, like The Mummy, which ostensibly, in theory, is kind of like a horror film on a grand scale.
But it's a
isn't
big
actually a horror
budget.
Film. It's a big action film set in a big cinematic universe, kind of taking all of the hallmarks.
There were scary bits in the game.
There was a little bit scary. Coming
from our expert scary opinions, there was definitely some bits where I was like, oi.
But
Sean's handy.
I don't think that the $40 to $80 million film really exists anymore in Hollywood.
There are exceptions, like your Arrivals.
Yeah, every now and again, I think you'll get one, but predominantly you're getting your $100 to $200 million.
Again, so while there are limitations on the genres that go for the big ones, in that mid-range budget, you're looking at comedies, horror, and probably crime.
Yep.
They're going to hit that middle bit.
But even like a lot of comedies these days, you look at the budget, and it's like $100 million.
And because of the star power.
Yeah.
You know, you look at the Jumanji film that's coming out, the Jumanji Welcome to the Jungle.
Yep.
You can't tell me that film like wasn't made for millions and millions of dollars because it has The Rock, Kevin Hart, and Jack Black starring in it.
And can I say I'm so on board?
Oh, yeah. Me too. Yeah. I'm so excited for that.
Sign me right up.
Oh my god! It's so good.
I don't have like much nostalgic connection to the original Jumanji.
It's good.
I saw that trailer and I was like, oh shit!
Just The Rock staring off in the distance, going, "Don't cry, don't cry."
Fuck! I'm so excited.
Basically, I love the fact that you have these four big actors. Playing
all playing against type.
Playing against type.
I don't think Kevin Hart is against type, but
but as in having to play kids. Other people.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see The Rock play like a dweeby guy.
Oh, I can't wait.
But it's even
man.
Like Kevin Hart, who normally is like the angry small man.
He's an angry
the
small man,
big man.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So that'd be great.
Gets turned into an
confident
angry small
big man,
man
and then you've also got Jack Black playing a woman.
Which
I can't wait. I think it's going to be good.
Oh, sign me up. There you go. And that's blockbuster.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Would the original Jumanji be a blockbuster? Would we say?
Oh, I think so.
High budget, Robin Williams.
Yeah.
And like maybe it's a moot to sort of say, oh, you know, what's gonna be the next kind of superhero or the next Western or the next musical or whatever. Because I mean, I think if you go back to the late 90s, nobody would have anticipated that the superhero comic book film would go the way it went.
Yeah.
Because at the time they were kind of a joke. And then it was like slowly in the 2000s, they kind of crept up.
I think they crept up and became commercially successful through your Hulks and probably your Spider-Mans and your X-Mans.
Yeah.
And then they became legitimate avenues for story and actors to go, oh, I want it. Like good actors going, oh, and I want to do a superhero film because of Christopher Nolan's Dark Knight trilogy.
So maybe, I mean, like, I don't know. I can definitely say that what I kind of hope happens is that the superhero bubble bursts and we get a sort of, not a repeat, but
an
like
80s
a
renaissance.
Like a new sort of new Hollywood era where you've got, you know, your film school brats kind of coming up, kind of making new stuff, doing like, you know, where there is room for a lot of like mid-budget but still high concept films like your Jaws's, like your Star Wars, like whatever, to get out there and get made. And yeah, a lot of them will bomb. I mean, like, it's surprising to me how many like high concept sci-fi films I hear about from the 80s with like, you know, well-known stars in them. Where it's like, I've just never heard about that before.
Yeah.
Because it just bombs and gets forgotten because back then people were just making films and just like throwing shit at the wall and seeing what stuck.
Do you know where you're probably going to get the mid-budget is you're absolutely right. It's going to be sci-fi. Sci-fi or horror.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So that's where you got to look. So if you're looking for where the next blockbusters or the next antithesis to the blockbuster are going to be in that mid-budget film, you're looking at the guys who do Arrival and things like that.
Yeah.
Dennis Villeneuve.
Yeah. Who's doing, although
he's doing Blade
having
Runner.
Said that, through the success of his other films, he has now landed Blade Runner, which is a budget.
But I think
it should be good.
Blade Runner, the first one, isn't a blockbuster. Well, it's cult. It got a cult following.
Yeah. It's also a little bit shit.
But I mean, yeah, I think if I'm gonna anticipate anything, it's the fact that, all right, so the films vie for the Chinese release dates. They vie to be appealing to an international audience. So we get a lot of like big, dumb blockbusters get made. People in America stop seeing them or see less of them or, you know, veer for the things that are a bit different because, you know, eventually people will be like, I just don't want to see another exactly the same Marvel film.
Yeah, Gabe, what do you think it's going to take to burst the comic bubble?
I just think
people are
going
to wait for phase three to finish, right?
Yeah.
But Kevin Feige,
Yeah.
Kev.
MC Kev. Kev. MCU Kev. Has said that after phase three, they're not thinking of another phase. They'll do other films that'll tie in together, but there's not like a phase plan.
Okay, that's kind of...
Which makes me think, will the bubble burst after phase three?
Hopefully.
Will people get to the end of Infinity War and go, I waited 10 years for this?
I just wonder what the reason's going to be, because you can... I would think the reason the 90s action film bubble burst had a lot to do with 9/11, I would say, just because people didn't want to watch that sort of stuff anymore.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like Roland Emmerich, you know, would watch that footage on the news and be like, this is the kind of stuff I was making and now I feel like shit. I know James Cameron was in development on True Lies 2, and then after that happened, he was like, we can't make fun of this anymore and that sort of thing. And that changed and led to whatever the next iteration was.
But then, see, that gave us Jason Bourne.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
And new Bond.
Yep.
And eventually,
that harder-edged
and
action.
Eventually we've now finally been able to come back to Roland Emmerich and those guys making those kind of films, I think, now.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's interesting. You're saying that terrorists killed Roland Emmerich's film career, or did he have a hand in that? He probably had a hand in that with that really great film he did about Shakespeare.
Oh, what was that?
Anonymous. Was like 2 or 3 years ago. It was long after 9/11.
Yeah, it's a weird film, though.
Okay.
I'm going to make a blockbuster. What, it's in Victoria or England? Yep. And it's about Will Shakespeare.
Wasn't it well reviewed?
No, I don't think so. Oh, I think it was pretty strongly savage.
No, because it was... People were like, no, that's not the story. A lot of Shakespeare people got very angry. Yeah. I talk to them on a regular basis when we go to Blockbuster and along together.
Yeah, so I guess the evolution of the Blockbuster, it has been, I mean, it's fascinating in a lot of ways to kind of look at what's trending, how things sort of develop, how things evolve, I guess. But yeah, coming into it now, I think it is inevitable that sooner or later the superhero franchise universe bubble, maybe I don't even think it'll burst. I think it'll just slowly peter off.
The Pixar bubble's a little bit. Pixar bubble's deflating.
Yeah.
So the superhero bubble should surely follow if they just keep churning out sequels and the same stuff.
Maybe the really good ones will kind of float to the top, but sooner or later, I don't think it's like going to be an overnight thing where suddenly Homecoming comes out and no one goes and sees it. And then nobody goes and sees Ragnarok and nobody goes and sees this and this and this. I mean, there is also an audience investment in those films. So it's like it'll be interesting to see what happens once those contracts are up. Once your Chris's leave, once Robert Downey Jr. gets fed up.
Yeah. Once your Infinity War Part 1 and 2 come out and end. Because Danny Jr.'s contract's already pretty much done.
Also, on top of that, I'm like, Infinity War is going to be fascinating because even though it's definitely the culmination, at the same time, I mean, this is a huge money-making machine now. It will still have the responsibility to set up the next 8 million films while culminating all the previous ones. So it'll kind of be like a civil war where it's like, oh, this is a game changer, but not really. Because we still have to kind of keep the ball rolling for the next one.
Marvel have a little bit of intelligence here, and I just think that they'll eventually figure out the landscape and probably have to make smaller budgeted films.
Yeah.
Every now and again, you'll have your bigger ones, but I think you'll cop hits. You'll cop shit ones like Doctor Strange or Thor 2 and stuff like that, and they'll become more aware of that, I think. So I think they'll have to if they want to survive.
I think ultimately, I don't know how it's going to go, but I'm fascinated to see where it goes.
Oh, we're in for a really interesting 20 years.
Yes.
Of film and blockbuster.
If you live that long, Tom.
Yes, because I fear another Rogue One might just break me.
Hang on.
On that note.
Hang on. Does that mean you're going to murder me? Are you going
to... No, dude, don't relax. It'll be a murder-suicide.
Yeah. Oh, so will I choke on my own ambition? Oh, I'm dead now.
Choke on something.
Oh, quick shit.
Look, you know what? I thought it might be 20 years, but it's going to be 20 minutes. So there we go. And on that note, I've been Gabe.
I will be Handsome Tom for a little bit longer.
I've been Carney.
And yeah, if you guys have any thoughts on the evolution of the Blockbuster or what's good, what's bad, whether we're wrong, whether we're right, hit us up at moviemaintenance@sanspants.com. That's our email. Otherwise on Twitter, we're at @mmsanspants or I'm at @gobergmoser.
I'm at @awkwardtreed.
I'm at @sidekickofdowie.
And we will see you next time.
Wolf of Wall Street is a blockbuster.
Hey everyone, Gabe's new book, Boone Shepherd's American Adventure, is now available as an audiobook over at sanspantsradio.podkeep.com. So feel free to go check that out and help support Gabe in his future career as a voiceover artist / audio Elvis impersonator. Right now, here's a sample of the first chapter of Boone Shepherd's American Adventure.
Chapter 1. You know what I hate about 1884? Promethea asked. I rolled my eyes. I'd been trying to enjoy the view of the city, by myself, but I could not be so lucky. Everything? Everything, she exclaimed. Absolutely everything about this era is awful. How did anybody ever survive here?
They didn't have you to put up with, I said, leaning on the barrier and looking out over the spread of buildings in the early morning. New York, a city still creating itself as people flocked here from other countries, determined to build something from the dust. If I squinted, I could pretend it was London in 1965. I blame you, she said. I really do. I don't want to wait 80 years to get home. You only have to wait 60, I said. Then I don't know what happens. You remember the laws of time travel. Two versions of yourself can't exist at the same time. Laws of time travel, Prometheus scoffed. I still can't believe that's a thing. Well, it is, I snapped, turning away. We'd had this same conversation roughly 700 times on the ship as we stowed away to America, and then again after arriving. For far too long now, I had been stuck with Promethea. We had spent some frantic weeks together in London, trying to find out who had taken the time machine, or when they had taken it to, while everyone around us celebrated Christmas and welcomed the new year. Eventually, the panic wore off, and I realized that every day I spent in London brought me closer to being caught and hanged. So we fled to America. You know what would help me take a stronger interest in the laws of time travel? Promethea said. Having possession of a time machine. And we did have one of those, but you left it unguarded and now we don't, I replied. So don't bother going on about it. It's your fault. Of course, it's my fault for coming back for you, she grumbled. I wasn't going to take her bait. I turned and headed for the door that led back down to our makeshift home. As I made my way down the wrought iron stairs, Promethea trailed after me. Why did it have to be America? She said. Of all places. The people here are insufferable. Last country in the world I ever wanted to visit. I don't know, I think you fit right in. Hilarious, Shepherd. How droll. I glanced back at her with a raised eyebrow. You've been spending too much time around Oscar. We reached the landing and I opened the wooden varnished door of the apartment. It was a luxurious place, full of plush couches, paintings, ornate rugs, and bookshelves packed with hefty volumes. It was also clearly built for one person, as was made evident by the single bedroom to the side, and the two hammocks that had been strung up in the small living area. Speaking of which, Promethea strode over to the door and knocked loudly. Wild, you useless slob! Get up! I'm hungry! Peters, it is your turn to make breakfast, came the muffled reply. I did it yesterday, I muttered, climbing into my hammock and lying back. Yeah, Wild, Shepherd did it, Promethea said, which makes it your turn. The door burst open. I glanced over. Wearing a fluffy pink dressing gown, Oscar stood in the doorway. Hands on hips. Is it not enough, he said, that you have invaded my privacy and turned an apartment designed for one into a can of sardines? Shepherd, Wild just called us sardines. Damn it, woman, that was patently a simile. Metaphor, I said, reaching behind my glasses to rub my tired eyes. Do not start, Shepherd. I am the playwright here and I know what a simile is. I'll show you a simile if I don't get some breakfast, Promethea said. Oh, good, the dictionary is on the table, Peters. Time to prove you can read. I rolled over, putting my back to them and my eyes to the window. The view from here wasn't as interesting as on the roof, but it was better than watching the same argument that played out every morning I didn't make breakfast, and even some when I did. Most of the time I ended up doing it just to shut them both up. Shepherd, back me up here, Promethea said. It's Wild's turn. I don't care, I said. It was too easy to imagine what a life here would be like if we never found a way home. Boone, do stop with the moping. It's becoming quite tedious, Oscar said. I rolled back to face them. I only just started moping, I snapped. And besides, I'm not moping. You just said you were moping, Promethea pointed out. Well, if I'm moping, it's because listening to the two of you endlessly argue makes me mope. Allow me to point out that I'm involved in the argument and I managed to resist the temptation to mope, Oscar pointed out. Yeah, come on, Shepherd, Promethea said. Be more like me and Wild. Wild and I, Oscar said. That's it. I slid from the hammock and made straight for the door. That is breaking point. I'm out. Oh, good, are we leaving? Promethea said, hurrying to join me. I spun to face her. I am going for a walk, I said. A long walk. If I don't come back, it's because I found the time machine and abandoned both of you here, which would be exactly what you deserve. Promethea inhaled sharply, and her eyes went wide with fear. We looked at each other for a moment. I'm sorry, I mumbled. Cabin fever. Promethea nodded and looked away. I met Oscar's gaze over her shoulder. He was frowning slightly, and I knew what he wanted to say. We don't want to stay here any more than you want us to, I said. But we don't have much choice. We've got no money and nowhere else to go. I know that, Oscar said. Perhaps it's time to think about getting jobs. Promethea turned to him. I have a job, she said. One I'll be returning to before long. You won't be returning anywhere if you spend your days sitting around my apartment moping, Oscar said. I don't mope, that's Shepherd's area. I pushed through the door and out into the hallway.
Footsteps sounded from behind me as I made for the staircase at the end. "Go away, Promethea," I said. Wiser words were never spoken. Oscar followed me, still wearing his dressing gown. "Boone, we need to discuss this." "I need fresh air." "You need a plan." "I never..." Shepard, repeatedly stating you never have a plan is a terrible catchphrase. "How do you know what a catchphrase is?" "Peters was cruel enough to inform me of the atrocities the future has committed against the English language, and you're changing the subject." We reached the stairs and I started down them. Oscar didn't stop. "The fact is this, sooner or later you will have to act. I know you have been through a lot, but it has been months since your brother died. Months of stagnation. Not having a plan isn't working for you." We reached the landing. I walked out into the bustling streets, hoping that the indignity of wearing that dressing gown in public would make Oscar turn back. It did not. "You have options, Boone. You simply have to look for them. You could..." "What?" I came to a halt and faced Oscar. "Go back to England and clear my name? They would hang me before I could convince anyone of anything. I brought shame and scandal to Huxley's paper, so he won't help me. Even if I had the first idea of where the time machine is, I've no way of knowing when it is. So looking for it isn't a smart option. Promethea and I searched Reculius's lab top to bottom after he died, so we know there's no other portal there. I can't get another job as a journalist. I'm too well known in those circles. And I'm not qualified to do anything else. Where would that leave Promethea anyway? Oscar, I'm not just sitting around brooding. I've thought of everything." For a moment, Oscar stared at me. Then he closed his eyes and sighed. "The fact remains, Boone, I have my own life and my own problems. You are my friend, and I care for you a tremendous amount, but I simply cannot keep providing for you. You are putting me at risk every second you remain, not to mention the toll Peters has already taken on my sanity." I looked away. Oscar was right, of course. Even coming to him for sanctuary had been asking too much, and he would have been well within his rights to turn us away. I was grateful he hadn't, and now we had long overstayed our welcome. But we had no other option. Yet. "Let me think about it," I said. "But one way or another we'll be gone within the week. I'll come up with something." It's a curious and unpleasant thing, not knowing what to do. And as Oscar departed to enjoy a solitary breakfast surrounded by all the attention his dressing gown would earn him, the weight of my situation felt heavier than ever. Sometimes company can distract you, while standing alone on a crowded street in an unfamiliar city can make it much clearer just how dire things are. I missed home. I missed the English countryside and the strange stories I found there. I missed lying under the stars, looking up into their infinite expanse and letting my mind wander. I missed solving murder mysteries and fighting sinister train conductors and saving mythical creatures and uncovering the truth about haunted houses. All of that, as terrifying and stressful as it could be, was home. Home was the open sky and my motorbike. Home was freedom. And while I could leave New York City and go pretty much anywhere in this country, that wasn't what I wanted. What I wanted was to be back where I belonged, away from my horrible past. Even just having my motorbike would be a comfort, one small taste of the life I wanted to run back to. But motorbikes didn't exist in 1884, where Boone Shepherd was a wanted murderer, and the fields of England were a place he could never return to. And without a bike or a case to solve, I didn't feel much like Boone Shepherd at all. Wandering the streets of New York, hands in pockets and eyes downcast, I let that particular misery wash over me. I refused to consider a future here, which meant that as far as I could see, there was no future. And that wasn't a thought I wanted to dwell on, which left one imperfect solution. We needed to act. I found Promethea that afternoon when I returned to the apartment, feet up on the couch, reading through a pile of papers. "You know, I can't figure out why Oscar Wilde is so famous back home," she said. "This story is rubbish. It's almost as bad as your version of events." "Leave him alone, it's a draft," I said. "We need to get thinking. I told Oscar we'd move out within a week." "You did what?" She dropped the papers, all attention now on me. "I don't want to move." "I'm aware of that," I said, "but we've intruded long enough. We need to figure out a course of action." "Like what?" she said. "Don't you think if we had a course of action, we would have taken it by now?" "Maybe, maybe not," I said, "but we can't stay here." "I beg to differ." "I don't care what you beg. We're leaving and that's it. If we have to live on the streets, we will." "You will," she snapped. "I'm not moving." "Then I'll call the police and tell them you're a burglar with especially bad manners." "Fine," she flew to her feet. "I'll tell them you're England's most wanted murderer." I froze. For a moment, we stared each other down. She looked away. "Sorry," she mumbled. "I didn't mean that." I shook my head. I had nothing else to say. "But I stand by the other thing," she said, We don't have anywhere to go, Boone. And unless an opportunity knocks on this door... There was a knock at the door. Frowning, Promethea and I glanced at it. Then at each other, then back at the door. Oscar usually preferred to entertain friends elsewhere. Nobody knew we were here. Slowly, heart racing, I approached the door. Promethea followed, looking as wary as I felt. I hesitated, then turned the handle and pulled open the door. A wide-eyed redhead girl of about 15 stood there, wrapped in a long coat and hugging herself. Upon seeing me, her face broke into an expression of pure relief. "Boone Shepherd," she said in a breathless Texan accent. "Howdy, and thank heavens, you're the only one who can help."
Thanks for listening. If you want to hear the rest of the story, part one is available for free over on the Boone Shepherd RSS feed. Just search for Boone Shepherd on iTunes, or you can purchase the complete audiobook over at sanspantsradio.podkeep.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.